Okay. Thank you and good morning, everyone. So my talk will mainly be on a methodological aspect that I'm using during my research in Rwanda and Burundi, since this panel is on field-based analysis of traditions. And so I'll give you a brief introduction, and then I focus on that methodology that is mainly centered around life stories and subjective ratings. And then I give you some examples from the case studies that I'm focusing on, Rwanda and Burundi, and then to come to a sort of concluding remark, because what I'm going to show is, because all the examples I will give in itself are sort of papered and developed, all the different examples will be used in different papers, so I'll just give you some findings of the methodology that I'm using. Of course, as everyone here, I'm working in a general framework of transitional justice, dealing with the past, in the context of political transition. So I'm working with two other researchers in a larger project, and we're trying to understand how political transition and transitional justice interact. There's a lawyer focusing more on transitional justice issues from the top down, and political scientist more on the political transition aspect. Me, as an anthropologist, I'm doing the same thing, but in small communities, small villages in Rwanda and Burundi. So political transition, I define it as regime change, going from one regime into the other. And often this is analyzed top-down with a focus on a specific set of political processes and actors. But there are some unobserved variables, especially the element of what is going on at the local level and the local perceptions of ordinary people. And especially also in the context of countries like Rwanda and Burundi, there are some structural features at play also at the local level, ethnicity. We're dealing here with two countries that are characterized by the fact that you have two ethnic groups competing over power in the course of time. So my question is then, so how does these unobserved variables in the countryside, ethnicity, governance, rural life, we're dealing here with societies with more than 90% of the population being peasants living in the countryside. So what I'm trying to do in my research is to explore some of these unobserved variables, and in general to bring back the peasants into the social and political processes of the state, as Catherine and David Newberry have phrased it. In addition, taking that bottom-up perspective, I'm trying to understand issues and events that happen. They are, of course, perceived and experienced differently by the different parties involved, based on the different identities. I'm trying to understand, is there a difference in the experience or the perception of these realities? So I'm going through the methodology now. And so I first have to say I spent 20 months in Rwanda doing research in the countryside, and I use all kinds of techniques. The idea is to have through a mixed methods approach to bring together a lot of data and to come to a sort of integration of all these data. So, but what I'm going to present here now is focus on the life stories. So you have on the one hand the quantitative aspects with the survey and other aspects, and you have more qualitative interviews, focus group discussions, and then observations. My main focus also in the recent period of my research was on the Gachacha. So in the villages where we stayed, we made a lot of observations on the Gachacha, the operating of the Gachacha courts in Rwanda. While in Burundi there is no official transitional justice policy going on for the moment, so in Burundi, when we stay there, and I say we because I refer to my research assistants, we were observing ordinary life and how people interact again after a period of violence. So what we have here is, on the one hand, quantitative or establishing the breadth of the study through a significant number of respondents that are selected through more statistical selection procedures. And on the other hand, you have more case studies focusing on villages and individuals and their life stories, group discussions. So what I'm focusing on here is the instrument of the life story and the letter of life. I started doing this in Rwanda because, as you know, or if you don't know, then I'll tell you now. But Rwanda is a specific environment where people not always, because of the violence that they have experienced, distrust is pervasive. But also, people have sometimes difficulties to express their opinions freely due to a history that goes way back of a very authoritarian system where they live. And so I always had problems when I talked to people to make them express freely. Now, the fact that I returned over the years every time to those places was already, helped a bit in creating trust. But on the other hand, well, it was of course difficult to ask them direct questions on these issues of democracy and transitional justice. So I had to develop an instrument that would allow me to assess these things without asking direct questions. So I started collecting life stories. And through a life story, they're not only telling their own story, but they also tell the story of what it means to live through a transition. So what I'm trying to understand, what does it mean to live through a transition? So I did the typical life story stuff, like you go several days in a week to the same person, you collect a lot of information, but it's very unstructured, and I wanted to have established the breadth of the study as well. So I had to structure the interviews to be able to do more interviews with more people. So we identified several teams based on focus group discussions, but these are also teams that are identified, for example, in the UNDP report on human security and every report of World Bank on Voices of the Poor. So these are important issues in the life of ordinary people, the socio-economic situation, of course, the feeling of security, confidence, social cohesion, how people interact with others, and especially in the context of Rwanda, Burundi, the other ethnic group, and then political representation. So when we did this field story, we did the life stories, but in addition we added another element, and that's the letter of life. I will explain it in a minute. But these two elements, they give me, on the one hand, they give you a lot of narratives of people explaining how they lived through all these transitions and horrible periods of violence. And so you have a lot of information there. But through the rankings, you also have a quantitative element where they place themselves on a ladder. So in the analysis, I'm using both elements to come to a sort of conclusion and trying to understand these issues. So this is the ladder of life. And so during the interviews, we use this. I'll show you a picture. And what we explain is, well, you have two sides on the ladder. You have a positive side and you have a negative side. And for all these issues, we explain, like, on the top side, there are the people who are best off in the economic situation, or the people who are best off for security, for example, in your local community. Yeah. On the bottom side are the people who are worst off for security, people who are worst off who don't trust anybody else. So then we ask the person, him or herself, to place him for all the period of all the years or periods in the life period that they have explained in their life story, to place themselves for these different teams on this ladder. So they make an assessment in comparison with the place where they live, and also in connection with their larger life period. So it works very well, because what is behind it is things like this. So if you go into the countryside, for example, in Rwanda and Burundi, you would think, well, everybody is poor. But it's not really the case. There are differences in being poor. So these are categories of stages you can go through of being poor in the economic situation, and reasons why you can move up or why you can go down. And this is now for the economy. And so, for example, these are in the local language different groups that exist related to poverty. Like on the top, you have those who have money, who are rich, who have a job, while on the bottom, you really have those who have nothing in the house. So this is to see the idea of some mental stages that always exist and where you can go through, and that's a bit what is behind the ladder of life exercise. And it also exists, the issues of security. You can have stages of security that always exist, and way of absolute security. Even in times of crisis, people know what good security is, and the fact that they can be in such a stage at one point, but not in another point in time. So here you see one of my collaborators doing such an interview, and you see the ladder of life where the people then themselves place themselves at the same time. So he's collecting the life story. So to come to some of the findings with the case studies in Rwanda and Burundi. So maybe just a small explanation. The select again, I'm using, I'm an anthropologist, but you see I'm using also some of the quantitative techniques because in general I have a bit of problem with anthropologists who have very in-depth information from very precise, small sample of people or places. That is very interesting, but I'm always asking, well, yeah, but maybe it's just that place or that person. And on the other hand, I have a problem with the typical surveys that give you the breadth of the study, but where you miss a lot of, well, okay, what's the process behind all these numbers? So again, in the selection, I go to different places, and the selection I had information on the number of people killed in Rwanda. So I wanted to establish a variance geographically, because you know the north was the former regime, and then you have places where more to the south, and so I had information on the number of people killed, and based on that I also wanted to establish a variance in places where there were high numbers of people killed and smaller numbers. Burundi is a bit similar, but at the same time a bit different, because they didn't have the numbers of the people killed. But here I established made a historical choice. Burundi was characterized by, different from Rwanda, several moments in time, massacres. So I went to some places who were at some point characterized by a massacre, and I also incorporated, for example, places where there were was never violence, again to establish the variance. So the selection of respondents, again, we want to understand also whether the different identities have a different perception of the same reality. So I needed to, and of course ethnicity is important. The problem is, in Rwanda you cannot talk about ethnic identity anymore. So the question was, how are we going to, and we want to know, because it's important. So how are we going to do this? So we collected lists of all the people in the village, and we identified people based on their sub-ethnic identities. And it's possible to identify people on the fact whether they're rescapé or whether they're prisoner. In Burundi, we did something similar, because there it's more related to mobility. A lot of people fled the country, went to camps. And these subgroups somehow, they fit with the larger ethnic categories. Sometimes it's not the case, but then during the actual interview, when we went to them, and it turned out that these people, because during the interview, they tell you there's no problem. But then when it turned out that the person was not Hutu or Tutsi as we expected, then we recategorized it, and it came into another group. So here you see the numbers. So we did about 460 people, or 409 people in Rwanda. The different categories: Hutu accused in Gacaca, Hutu not accused in Gacaca, never been in prison, released prisoners, and then for Tutsi you had survivors and all caseload returnees. In Burundi it was a bit more complicated. There you have displaced Hutu repatriates, immobilized rebels, also liberated prisoners, who ended up in prison after the killings in 1993. You have Tutsi who have never left their hill. You have people now demobilized soldiers who are always or almost always Tutsi, because the former army was Tutsi dominated. You have displaced who still live in camps that are always Tutsi, and then former displaced. So it's about 360. So these categories, we select them in the villages, and then through a random sampling, we select some people to talk to, and then afterwards in the analysis, these numbers are weighted to balance a bit the selection procedure. Okay, elements to take into account before we go to the findings, and I think I should go a bit faster. So we're talking about perceptions. So they're not indicators of security, or indicators of perceptions of security. Okay. And then, well, take it into account, I go to the findings. So these are the main findings for Rwanda, where you see the different teams: economy, security, confidence, and political representation. You see, of course, again, in the perceptions, we started in the 80s, 1980, you have the scale plus 5, minus 5, and then you see the differences, the impact of the genocide. What I show you here already is the breakdown according to ethnic identity. So reds are Tutsi respondents, and green are Hutu respondents. Similar, and I come back to some of the issues, similar here for Burundi, you see a similar tendency. It's a bit less pronounced than in Rwanda, but you also see the impact of 1993, but even 1988 when there was a massacre. So you can do a lot of things now. You can identify certain subgroups, like for example demobilized rebels. You can go to their life stories and first try to understand why in the first place they started, they went into the rebellion. And also now you see the tendency that this is for political representation, that it goes down. So they have been demobilized, but there are not many sources of they don't find any jobs. So the grievances are starting, and it's a potential source of violence because there will be elections in the future, and you hear some rumors of recruiting them. What you can do also is decentralize it and compare different hills. These are two hills in Rwanda, and it's you see there can be very big differences according to the place in Rwanda. So this place, you see, Hutu and Tutsi and all the other categories are very close to each other, while in the other place, it's very far apart. So the perceptions can be very different. And then you have the analysis, why is this? And then based on the observations, you see how local governance functions. And so you can learn a lot, like, why is it working here? And we can identify these variables, for example, also to see what elements should be necessary to increase social cohesion. Similar things in Burundi economy, like the bottom hill, there was no violence. You see the impact, what it has on the economic situation. You can compare Rwanda and Burundi. So all these things, I'm doing that in separate papers. So if you want to, maybe in the near future, some of them will be out. So if you're more interested, you can find it there. One of the things that I find very interesting is that you have the genocide. At the same time, you have the military overthrow in Rwanda. So what you see, and you see it also in Burundi, in fact, is there you have not a military overthrow, but in 2005, the Hutu-dominated CNDD comes to power. And also there in the perceptions, you have a reversal of ethnic dominance. So you see two trends. It's not like what Hutu extremists would say, who are outside of the country, that Hutu are living in a state of fear. I mean, there are problems, and there is a gap between Hutu and Tutsi respondents. And if you analyze the life stories, but even in Burundi, it's related to issues of power and how local governance functions, and also with the identity of power hold. Another thing that is visible is, for example, the impact of Gacaca. So this is in Rwanda, the feeling of security, where you see that when Gacaca starts, at least in the initial phase, there is a central tendency of things getting better. And then it's not that it's going down, it's very subtle, but at least it blocks off similar things with confidence. You see a similar tendency, and it's reflected also, it's corroborated by a large-scale survey done by the National Unity and Reconciliation Commission, where you see that the element of cohesion and conflict is diminishing and conflicts are rising. So it proves that somehow through this technique you can capture a general trend in society. Just to conclude and connect it a bit more with the narratives. In Burundi, this is the graph for social cohesion. So what you see is 2003. This is so the bottom lines, a red line is the trust of Tutsi versus Hutu, and the red line is the trust that Hutu have versus Tutsi. So what you see after the war, it's increasing. So the social cohesion, the confidence is getting better. So, and in Burundi for the moment, they're discussing what are we going to do for transitional justice. So they have a truth commission that is envisioned, as well as a special tribunal. But in the life stories, what you see is that, okay, for the moment there is cohabitation, but there's still some problems, some distrust. For them, reconciliation is often referred to the heart. And that's what you see also in this graph, that for the moment, they're exploring each other's hearts. The war is over, And in daily interactions, sharing of beer, being invited in a ceremony, that's the reason why the cohesion is increasing. Of course, this can be reinforced by a certain transitional justice institution, but at least it needs to be something that is built on what is already existing in the population, in my opinion. I'm not going to go into this because it would take us too far, but this is, for example, related to the narratives and the ideas that are expressed of are we going to deal with the past or not, digging up something or leaving it a stone there under the earth. But then we go more into the actual narratives and we use the fraud. Thank you.